Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all ready to ride?
Everyone, and thanks for tuning in to Injust Us, the show that allows listeners to share stories of injustice, ask questions, and seek advice. Each week, we feature guests who are making a difference in the Black community and or changing the criminal justice system. My name is Melinda Robertson, and I am your host. I'm an author, activist, and advocate from Washington, D.C., and member of the WPGR All-Female Radio Network. I am the founder of Black Mothers for Justice, Inc., a 501c3 nonprofit organization created to provide a safe space where mothers can speak openly about the hurt, pain, shame, and guilt they carry without being judged. We often hear stories about innocent Black men wrongfully convicted, being exonerated after spending years in prison, but we rarely hear about their mothers, many of whom died long before justice is served. It is too heavy a burden to carry alone, so our mission is to bring Black mothers together and allow them an opportunity to speak their truth and begin the healing process. On this coming Saturday, August 1st, 2020, Black Mothers for Justice will be holding its second virtual meeting for mothers of inmates. The first one held July 3rd was so successful that we have committed to hosting monthly meetings. It was good to see the mothers relax, relate, and release the stress and anxiety they have been experiencing during the pandemic because most of them are suffering in silence, having been unable to visit their children for months, not speaking with them for days, sometimes weeks at a time, and the fear of COVID-19 weighing heavy on their hearts. The Zoom login details are posted on the promo flyer, which can be found on my Facebook page under author Melinda Robertson and the Black Mothers for Justice Facebook group page as well. In addition, on August 15th, 2020, I will be hosting a virtual book release party for A Black Mother's Guide, How to Survive the Criminal Justice System. This book was written out of necessity because statistics show that one in every three Black boys will go to prison in their lifetime, and that 72% of Black children are raised by single mothers. It is a much-needed resource guide that provides detailed information about the process following an arrest, arraignments, bail, public defenders, etc. I believe the more information Black mothers have about the criminal justice system, the better prepared they will be if their son becomes one of the three. You may pre-order your autographed copy in advance at www.blackmothersforjustice.com. Thank you so much for your support. As I prepare to introduce tonight's guest, I would like to remind callers to press the number one to join the conversation. Tonight's featured guest, Derek Hamilton of Brooklyn, New York, was sentenced to life in prison for a murder he did not commit in 1991. He was framed by the now retired police detective Louis Scarcella, whose murder cases have been under review by the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office. Cases linked to Scarcella came under scrutiny after the New York Times uncovered instances in which the detective relied on the same eyewitness, a drug-addicted prostitute, for multiple murder prosecutions, and he also delivered confessions from suspects who later denied making such admissions. In Mr. Hamilton's case, investigators determined the account by the only eyewitness was unreliable because she gave conflicting accounts to the police. On January 9, 2015, Mark Hale, the prosecutor in charge of the conviction review unit, told the judge that the district attorney had determined the conviction against Derek Hamilton could not stand. After 24 years, he had cleared his name. During Mr. Hamilton's incarceration, he obtained his GED and began studying law, becoming a highly sought-after jailhouse lawyer, helping his fellow inmates appeal their convictions. He pored over trial transcripts, filing motions on behalf of the inmates, and occasionally winning their appeals. Since becoming a free man, Mr. Hamilton has labored to overturn many convictions linked to Mr. Scarsella. He has worked with lawyers as a paralegal to investigate facts and has helped draft lawsuits and motions in support of new trials. Mr. Hamilton founded a support group called Friends and Family of the Wrongfully Convicted with another former inmate, Sude Moses, who was also arrested by Mr. Scarsella and was ultimately freed. He has partnered with the Innocence Project in an effort to persuade the New York Police Department to change the way in which its officers conduct interrogations. He has also undertaken a project to organize former prison inmates to work together as a voting bloc for criminal justice reform. Mr. Hamilton currently lives in New Jersey with his family and works in a small office that he shares with another paralegal. Since his victory in People versus Hamilton, he has received many more requests for help. Letters from prisoners cover his desk, and his cell phone rings constantly. The calls that trouble him most are those from inmates whom he knows personally and believes to be wrongly imprisoned. When you know a guy's innocent, if you have any decency or human elements in your being, it's almost impossible for a good person to just forget, he said. And that is my dilemma. Please help me in welcoming Mr. Derek Hamilton to the show. Hello, Derek. How are you this evening? Hello. We're going to take a brief intermission here. You're going to take a brief intermission. Thank you. Is that the same number you gave me early? Hello.
Life. I wonder. Will it take me under?
Smoking weed in the street without cops harassing. Imagine going to court with no trial. Lifestyle cruising blue Bahama waters. No welfare supporters. More conscious of the way we raise our daughters. Days are shorter, nights are colder. Feeling like life is over. These snakes strike like a cobra. The world's hot, my son got knocked. Evidently, it's elementary. They want us all gone eventually. Trooping out of state for a plate. Knowledge, if coke was cooked without the garbage, we'd all have the top dollars. Imagine everybody flashing. Fashion, designer clothes. Lacing your click up with diamond rolls. Your people holding dough, no parole, no rubbers. Going raw, imagine law with no undercovers. Just some thoughts for the mind. I take a glimpse into time. Watch the blimp read, the world is mine.
If I rule the world,
imagine that.
I free all my
days. Yo, it'd be paradise life relaxing. Black, Latino, and Anglo-Saxon. Armani exchange the range. Cast, Lord Travis Shabazz. Free at last. Brand new whips to crash. Then we laugh in the iller path. The villa houses for the crew. How we do? Trees for breakfast. Dime sexes and bend stretches. So many years of depression make me vision. The better living. Type of place to raise kids in. Opening eyes to the lies. History's told foul. But I'm as wise as the old owl. Plus the gold child. Seeing things like I was controlling. Click rolling. Tricking six digits on kicks and still holding. Trips to Paris, I civilize every savage. Give me one shot, I turn trite life to lavish.
political prisoners set free, stress free. No work release, purple M3s and jet skis. Feel the wind breeze in West Indies. I think Coretta Scott King, mayor of the cities, and reverse things to Willie's. It sound foul, but every girl I meet to go downtown. I'd open every cell in Attica, send them to Africa.
If I rule the world,
imagine that. Living worry, duck down in car seats, heat's mandatory. Running from Jake, getting chased, hunger for pace. These are the breaks, many mistakes go down out of state. Wait, I had to let it marinate. We carry weight, trying to get laced. Flip the A stack to safe. Millionaire plan to keep the gap with the cock hammer. Making moves in Atlanta, back and forth scrambler. Cause you can have all the chips. Be poor or rich, still nobody want a nigga have a shit. If I rule the world and everything in it, sky's the limit. I push the 245 infinite. It wouldn't be no such thing as jealousies or beef felony. Strictly living longevity to the destiny I thought I'd never see, but reality struck. Better find out before your time's out. What the fuck?
If I rule the world,
imagine that.
I free all.
Okay, we're ready to go, Derek?
Yes.
Okay, great. I'm sorry for the delay. My apologies. Derek, I've already did the intro and introduced you to everyone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for the introduction. I heard it all, and I'm pleased to be here.
Okay, good. Okay, I'm going to get right into it. I'm sorry, I do apologize.
No apologies needed.
Okay, great. So, wow, what, my goodness, your story is so amazing. It's so amazing. I'm so thankful that you agreed to be on the show to share your story. Let's go back to 1991. How old were you when you were wrongfully convicted of murder?
I was around 25 years old, right before my 26th birthday. I was arrested for shooting death of Nathaniel Cash in Brooklyn. I was convicted about 8 months later when I was about 26 years old and was sentenced to 25 years of life in prison for a murder I did not commit.
Wow. What went through your mind when you were sentenced to 25 to life in prison?
Well, before I was sentenced, I made a pro se motion to set aside the verdict, and it took about a year before the judge ultimately decided to sentence me despite the evidence that proved that I was innocent, or at the very least, that the young lady who accused me of the crime never saw the murder. For a whole year, the judge said he couldn't give me a day in prison, let alone 15 to 25 years. So the day in which he denied the motion and decided to sentence me was shocking. I was confused. I just couldn't understand, you know, how this judge could do this, despite the overwhelming evidence that proved I didn't commit the crime. I was just totally I was just in awe. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. And I just spent every single day of my incarceration thereafter fighting to get free.
Wow. Wow. Let's go back. You said you filed a what? Pro se what? Can you break that down? What is that you filed?
Once the jury returns a verdict, in most states you have a period of time when you can move to vacate or set aside that verdict based on constitutional violations or matters that appear in the record that will require reversal by a higher court. So for me, knowing the procedure and knowing that I had evidence that established that the sole witness that accused me never saw the crime, I availed myself of that opportunity and filed a motion to set aside the verdict. And I utilized a memo book from a police detective who was at the crime scene, who said he spoke to this witness, and the witness told him that she was not present at the time that the murder happened. This evidence never came out at my trial because they lied to my attorney and told my attorney that the statement was from someone else and not the young lady who testified against me at the trial. So when I learned of this deception and this lie and this fraud upon the court, I moved to set aside the verdict and argued that had the jury heard this evidence, the result of the proceeding would have been different. They would have found me not guilty.
Wow. So how did you know this, to do this? Where did you obtain that type of knowledge? You had knowledge of the criminal of law at that point?
Yes, when I was 17 years old, I was once again charged with a crime I didn't commit. I was sentenced to 42 and a half years in prison. The appellate division reversed those convictions in 6 years and let me out. It was my first brush with the law. I learned so much during that time about the criminal justice system and how they railroad blacks and Hispanics. How if you poor, you don't get the effective assistance of the counsel. So when they set me up in Scarcella, who felt that I didn't do enough time for the first crime, who thought I was guilty despite the fact that the court filed otherwise, when he framed me for the second case, I was well aware of what the criminal justice system do to blacks and Hispanics, and I was, well, at least I thought that I was prepared to fight them and prevail. But as you know, you're never a match for the system. Individual can never match it in a system who systemically is professional as a railroad black and Hispanics.
Wow. So you taught yourself law. First of all, you obtained your GED. Were you incarcerated when you obtained your GED?
Yes, I was in the Elmira Correctional Facility. In order to work in the law library, I had to obtain a GED. Kind of, you know, from the college you went from school, and I believe that, you know, a lot of times that you can be, you know, indoctrinated and institutionalized by the American educational system. However, I had to obtain that GED in order to go work in the law library. And, you know, a lot of times we say we taught ourselves, but there was a lot of older men in prison, you know, Joe Diaz and others, who taught me, Greg Wallace, and other older guys who actually put me up under their wing and showed me the ropes and taught me law and taught me procedure and taught me how important it was to understand the Constitution to empower myself to fight back against the racist injustice that I was receiving in the court.
Well, how old were you then when you first started studying law?
About 17 years old.
Wow.
There was an attorney by the name of Candace Kirst that my father hired, and she was the first one to educate me on how the system was railroading me and gave me two cases to study. And when I comprehended them, because I was always a good student when I was in public school, so, I mean, reading was one of my best subjects, so I was able to read and comprehend the cases, and I kind of liked it and understood what was going on. So from that moment, I began going to the law library every day and educating myself, reading every book they had so I can get some familiarity with what would go on when I go inside a courtroom.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. So, Derek, your mom passed away before you were released. Do you think your wrongful incarceration affected her health in any way? And how did you cope with such devastating news serving time?
My arrest and my conviction definitely broke my mother's heart. Again, I had just came home from a similar case like this when I ultimately prevailed and was able to get out, and to be framed and set up for another crime was just unbelievable. It was a story that you couldn't believe. I mean, my mother was just frantic about how this can happen to her son twice, not once, but twice. And sometimes she questioned, like, did the system really do this? Like, how the hell can they do this to a person twice? You sure? Yeah, let me do with this. And when I walked her through the evidence, I walked her through the facts and let her be her own determinative factor, and she understood and she believed in me, because she knew at that point what the system had did to me the first time. You know, she, over the years, she got older and began having heart problems and kidney problems and passed away. It was the most devastating blow of my imprisonment because I've always dreamed of getting out and spending more time with my mother and family. You know, it was just devastating not to be able to mourn with my family, to go to the gravesite and just sit there and you know, have a family moment of our childhood and just, you know, bury my mother properly. So that was the most devastating blow of my incarceration. And, you know, it was hurtful.
Wow, I just want to extend my condolences. I don't know if you heard the intro, but I mentioned during the intro that there are so many innocent black men that have been wrongfully convicted. And we hear about them being exonerated, but they rarely talk about their mothers. And
right.
I believe because a lot of them, unfortunately, die long before justice is served. So, again, I just wanted to give you my condolences.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. So you were a young father and had three children by age 18. How did your incarceration affect your relationship with them?
I mean, it really destroyed it. I mean, at that point, you go from walking your kids to school every day and helping them with homework to being absent. You know, one of my daughters, when I got out, she was about 21 years old. And every year for 21 years, I told her I was coming home. So at some point she said, look, stop lying to me. You know, you've been telling me this for 21 years. I don't believe you anymore. I mean, those are the most hurtful moments ever because I believed I was getting out of the year because I was innocent. Who would think that you would spend 21 years before the system realized that you didn't commit the crime? Or in my case, they knew I didn't commit the crime, but just said later for it. He's a bad guy. And because we believe he's a bad guy, we're going to keep him in the prison because we have the power to do so. I mean, the motion that ultimately got me out of prison was a motion in which I challenged the system and said that reasonable people conscious would be shocked to learn that the judge was just throwing evidence of innocence in the garbage. And that's what was happening in my case for 21 years, and it destroyed my relationship with my kids. Right now it's great because I'm out and I can be a loving father and grandfather. But, you know, at that point, you know, it's a trust factor. And, you know, my children are like, hey, you come home every day. You're not here. I did 10 years in special housing unit because I litigated from other prisons and was a target of racist correction officers who felt that I should be locked away, which was a solution, and me not being able to challenge them on civil rights violations and things like that. And your children's eyes, they just can't understand that, you know, why would people pick you out of all the people in the world? Sometimes they, again, start to believe the indoctrinations and the things they're taught and say, oh, this guy can't be a victim of everybody. And I wasn't a victim. I was litigating. And retaliation comes with litigating. But they couldn't understand that concept, and it was difficult trying to teach them to believe in a system that you yourself know has wronged you. So when I had conversation with them, even though I know I was wrong by the system, I had to empower them to be able to fight the system and do it by learning the laws. You do it by challenging and being assertive that you're entitled to. So it was very difficult. Now it's beautiful because I have been a testament of showing and proving that the things that I told them when they were younger was true. And my manifestation to that effect speaks more than the ordeal that I've been through.
Awesome. How long have you actually been home?
I've been home now since 2011, December, so almost 9 years.
Oh, that's such a blessing, such a blessing. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure they're glad to have their dad home.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to be home with them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, listen, I believe we have a caller. I want to also remind callers that you press 1 to speak with Derek and join the conversation. Caller, are you there? Okay, we'll come back. So, Derek, have you always been interested in law?
You know, I'll tell you this. I didn't understand law. I didn't even know what the law actually was until I was arrested. And what I'm doing now is trying to teach younger kids to get involved in the law from a different perspective. And that's one of the things we plan on doing with friends and family that were convicted, is engage young kids at a year earlier age and before they're actually caught up in the web of the judicial system to be young lawyers and show them how lucrative it can be and more than anything, how they can change the system. But from the moment that the lawyer gave me those two cases, and I was able to read and understand what was happening to me. It empowered me, and from that moment, I began to love the law. And then when I did some history and understood, you know, how the people of England during the Magna Carta had, you know, got King John at gunpoint and made them give them rights, it kind of was a revolutionary thought for me that we can change things from a law perspective. So I was very intrigued with it, and I just took it to another level.
Wow, that's excellent. That is excellent. So how long had you been incarcerated when you first started pursuing the law? Was it when you first, when this case happened, that's when you immediately, once you were sentenced to this 25 to life, did you just know then that you were going hard? You had some law experience behind you at that point, though, correct?
Yes. I mean, from the day that I was arrested, I mean, I went to the law library because I understood that the system wasn't fair. So, I mean, all of my days, every correction officer that knows me, every inmate that knows me, every prisoner that knows me, they would tell you that I spent all my waking hours in the law library. Any extra time that I can get, I applied for. I probably was the first one in there in the mornings, and if I could have been the last one out at night, I would have been. It was just nothing else in prison or the detention or whatever you want to call those places that meant anything to me more than the law. I just had to learn that I had to be the smartest person when I walk in that courtroom, and the only way to do that was just educate myself.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to try for the caller again. Caller, are you there? Would you like to join the conversation? Hello, caller. Okay, Derek, we're moving right along. So you were incarcerated for over 20 years. How did you maintain your sanity all those years and just never and not give up? Was it just being, you know, being consumed with the case, spending all your time in the law library, I imagine?
That's exactly what it was. That was therapeutic in itself, knowing that you're fighting back. And fighting for so many other people as well was therapeutic. It kept you so busy that you didn't have, you know, too much time to mourn. There was a lot of depressing moments. I'm not going to say that there wasn't. There was times when, you know, the dilemma has became bigger than the person. Being in a special housing unit for 10 years is kind of like unimaginable to understand what you go through in those environments. Constant depression every single day. You know, you're seeing mentally.
Y'all ready to ride? You the latest and the greatest of your lineage. Makeup and clothes ain't you, that's what your image is. Here's what it really is, perception is direction. You receive what you perceive, what you give is what you getting. This lesson is the weapon that I already gave you. Fear not, draw your gun, your God, universe, nature. Game changer, your higher self is calling you. The vehicle for change is arrived, what you wanna do? Traffic stop, we could be shot down, and in the courts it's just us, justice is not found. Roadblocks, checkpoints, and a lockdown. If you ain't strong, it won't be long before you knocked down. But there's another way, turn up what these others say. You the most important thing you have to think about today. So here's what I'ma say, listen while I'm rapping it. Your mind, that's a magnet, what you think you'll attract it. So ask it to manifest the things that you really like. Friends that you really like, not the hateful, silly type. Don't be deceived by greed, here's what it's really like. Their body drives a car, but their mind rides a mini bike. You know the person that you be and ain't all of you. The vehicle for change is a rob. What you want to do?
I want to take a ride. I want to feel the vibe. I'm feeling good inside.
Let's
rock. I want to take a ride. I want to feel the vibe. I'm feeling good. checking troubleshooting, moving down the line. I come up hopping, but that's okay. Call me trouble man.
Derek, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Derek.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Yes, I hear you clearly. I'm just so sorry about these technical difficulties. I don't know. Something going on in these airwaves. They don't want you to get this story out there, my brother, but we pushing through.
Right.
We pushing through,
it's
baby.
Right.
We pushing
right.
through. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we were saying that I was asking, the last question I asked you was why it was so important to you to prove your innocence after being, after you were released on parole.
Well, first of all, it wasn't just about me. There was other brothers that I know, the district detective that did it too. And again, I wanted to show my children that I wasn't a liar. I wanted to show the world that I wasn't a liar. More than anything, I wanted to fight back for the men and women who I knew that was in prison, that was innocent, who was being subject to the same thing that I was being subject to. So It was for me, it was a no-brainer to continue to fight, to continue to yell loud as I possibly could that I was innocent and that there were so many other men and women in prison that was innocent. And I wanted to change the narrative. I wanted to be their voice as well as my own voice.
Wow. So amazing. So amazing. I just want to remind callers to press 1 if you'd like to join the conversation. So, Derek, now that your conviction has been vacated, Can you go to law school and take the bar to become a lawyer? Why or why not?
Yeah. Yes, I can. I mean, I have the, you know, I've been offered accelerated courses. I've been offered a lot of incentives to get involved. But again, I come from a different school process, thought process. I'm an advocate first. I believe that when you become a lawyer, you lose that advocacy a lot. You're told by people what you can and cannot do in terms of censorship, in terms of gag orders, in terms of, you know, a lot of rules and regulations. Again, I'm an advocate first. So I would never give up the advocacy, because being able to go against judges and go against prosecutors and go against lawyers, I'm about. I don't want to become a part of a bar association that has systemically oppressed my people. I just think that my ancestors would be very, very ashamed of me if I gave up the freedom fighter that I am and became a part of, to me, the same system that's enslaving our people.
Wow. That's so profound. That is so profound. I hear you. So did the Innocence Project assist in your exoneration? If so, in what way?
No, they didn't assist in exoneration at all. There was a lawyer by the name of Jonathan Edelstein and Robert Grossman who was very instrumental in taking my case pro bono and helping me fight throughout the appellate process and in the exoneration process. And there was also an attorney by the name of Scott Brett Snyder who litigated throughout the course of the appellate division, as well as Ayanovo and others. But the Innocence Project did not. However, I've been working with the Innocence Project since I've been home in policy reform, and they're very great at it. We changed laws in New York State, tremendous criminal justice reform we worked on every single day. We've got the discovery laws repealed. We just did so much. Identification laws repealed, confession laws repealed. We changed the way that they do business in New York. So I definitely give much props to the Innocence Project. Without them, we wouldn't have the platform to do a lot of the things that we're doing today.
Wow, such a blessing. Such a blessing. So how was it? I know during the process when you were incarcerated and you were assisting other inmates with their cases, how was that for you to see some of their, during the appeal process, were any of them actually released with your work?
Yes, absolutely. Several was released. One of the ones that stand out is a young man by the name of Julio Acevedo, who was kidnapped, pistol whipped, and forced to commit a murder and told the system that when he got arrested. But because the individuals that did it to him were working with the police officers, they locked Julio up and let those guys go. I got Julio up. He did over 10 years before he got out. And he was accused of killing the real 50 Cent, the one where 50 Cent got his name from. It was a very, very high-profile case at the time. And that was one of the major cases that I won. Terrence Brazil was another murder case that I got reversed. There were several. But it always bothered me when the system knew that these guys were innocent or committed the crimes under arrest and was forced and just left them in prison. That just bothers me to my core to know that they're doing it just because they can, no other reason.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And there are so many wrongfully incarcerated people, and it's just so unfair. I experienced it with my own son. He was wrongfully incarcerated as well. So that's why I'm here. So involved in, and that's why I'm hosting Injust Us, to try to make a difference.
Well, we appreciate
so
that.
Appreciate you, Evan. Oh, thank you so much. So are you affiliated with the Innocence Project today? I think you just sense on that.
Yes, well, I would like to give shout outs to them as well. Rebecca Brown is a young lady over there who, is very, very mighty, very powerful around the country, and changing laws to make the criminal justice system more fair. And I'd just like to shout her out for all the work that she does. And you know, again, when they call me, I'm there. That is an organization that I'm always willing to work with, always willing to beat the ground and make some noise about the unjust policies that exist around the country. What people don't know is that the leading cause of wrongful convictions is false confessions, mistaken identifications, jailhouse informers who just lie to get a deal to get themselves out of prison, prosecutorial misconduct and ineffective assistance of counsel. A lawyer just that doesn't know or just doesn't have the time to prepare properly for trial. And when you talk about false confessions, people will be, well, why would a person confess to a crime he didn't commit? Because police officers are smart. They know how to induce statements out of people. They know how to keep them until they break down, and they lie to them and tell them all kind of things in order to get a confession out of them. And then when you talk about mistaken identifications, again, you got police officers who suggest to the witness that the person in number three is the one that committed the crime. Whether they show him a picture before he see the lineup or tell him what type of clothing the person is going to have on. So there's a lot of things we had to change. So now in the lineup, the cop that's doing the lineup don't know who the suspect is, so he can't tell the person who to pick out. And also doing video confessions, we had to change the law so that once a person comes in the precinct, he's on videotape, not just when he's doing a confession, but from the whole time he gets in the precinct, so we can observe what led up to his confession, what the cop said to him, what was said back and forth to determine the reliability of those things. So, I mean, we had to just change things in the system so they'd be more transparent and more fair. And Rebecca Brown and Innocence Project led the way, and I want to thank them for that.
I love it. So are these nationwide changes that's been made to the criminal justice system or specifically for New York City?
Well, state by state. I mean, you've got some states that was more progressive than New York. You had states like Texas that was before New York and changed. We just got these things done in New York last year when Texas, North Carolina, and places like South Carolina had them in effect before us. So, I mean, around the country, the wave is get these things done, their best practices. In some places, they don't have it. In some states, they don't. And we're still working on getting those changed. But, you know, we go all over. We go wherever there's injustice. And Rebecca leads the way. And Innocence Project leads the way. So I want to thank them on that.
Awesome, awesome. So, question, during your incarceration, did you by any chance ever connect with any of the exonerated five? I know you're very familiar with that case, but during your incarceration, did you ever connect with any of them?
I was in the maximum facility with Corey Wise. I believe he was in Windy Correctional Facility at that time. And, you know, one of the things that happened when you convicted of a crime like they were, of rape, you're shunned by the prison population, and most of the time those guys are in protective custody or some type of custody for their own protection. So I was never in a unit with him, but we was in the same facility. We never had any communication, anything, until he got out of prison. And, you know, I can honestly say he had a very, very tough time because, you know, people assumed that he was guilty. They presumed that he was guilty, and they treated him like that. Mm-hmm.
Wow, so sad, and that's the story of so many. Doing this work can become overwhelming at times, you know, because I read a lot and I'm following a lot of cases and stuff to get different people on the shows, and then I have a Facebook group as well that I also like to put, like today I posted about free Ronnie, what's his name, Ronnie Long, you know, and sometimes it's just so heavy. I mean, it's just heavy. I've never experienced anything like you guys have, but it's just so heavy. How do you, you know, how do you pull back from that? It's overwhelming. Like, how does Derek Hamilton just, like, you know, just relax and without all that heaviness? Because it's so heavy.
Well, you know, I tell you, it's very complicated. And, you know, it's the, you know, I believe for me is the work that you do and giving back speak volumes as to who you are as a person. So for me, it's just who I am, and it's definitely overwhelming. I mean, every single day, there's some case or another that I'm working on, and the work is tedious. You know, knowing that there's at least, by their numbers, and this is their numbers, 40,000 innocent men and women in prison every single day, and that one of these guys that wrote me could be one of them, or are one of them, is taxing. Because when I write a motion for attorney, or when I'm on the phone with the attorney or the prosecutor, I'm speaking for these guys. I'm arguing for these guys. And I'm saying, hey, look at the evidence. Don't close your eyes just because you can. And, you know, it's just the tone. I mean, a lot of times I'm yelling, I'm screaming, you know, at the lawyer, and we'd be friends. But, I mean, I'm saying you don't know what it felt like to be there. So,
Of course, you can nothing for another day or 2 days until you get back. But to this guy, that's a lifetime. You know, to his family, that's a lifetime. So, I mean, and then see how lackadaisical people are about getting to the case to give a guy justice. I got cases where the prosecutor agreed that there's something terribly wrong with the case, or the sole witness is unreliable, but that guy is still in jail. Those things are the most frustrating things in the world, when people in power take their time to give others justice because they don't know what it feels like to be locked in that cage and be treated less than a human being. So, I mean, that's the taxing part for me. I mean, having lived the experience and just to see how people go on with their lives out here, like it's nothing, like it's okay. And when it's them or somebody that they love, then you hear them, you know, speaking or complaining about it. But we need to be very, very vocal about it. We need to say, hey, if there's 40,000 people by your own numbers that's incarcerated, we want them out, and demand it and start voting in local elections and making sure that the prosecutors who are in charge of being fair is fair, not remove them. Put somebody in that's going to do the job. The buddy-buddy system that's been going on around the country, not just in New York, but around the country, you got prosecutors that's being elected because the police unions want somebody in that's going to protect them, because our voice is not being heard in local elections. We got to get out and vote. We got to get out and put people in office that care about us. And I think that is time. It's time for us to get out there and be heard, be counted.
Absolutely, absolutely. I believe we have a caller. Caller, are you available?
Are you
speaking to
me?
Please speak. Yes.
Oh, hi. How you doing? My name is Brenda. Derek, first of all, I want to commend you on all the work that you are doing, that you've done to make a difference in our community. It means so much. I know you've probably heard it over and over and over again, but, you know, it is about making a difference and helping those that are actually not able or in a position to help themselves, whether they may not have the money or the attorneys in powerful positions, including family members. Because usually it's about oftentimes family members who know people in certain cases that will help their loved ones or whatever get off, or they just have the money to do it. And in our community, we just don't have it to make bail. Even small amounts of bails, you know, even a small amount, a $5,000 bail oftentimes. And, you know, when I think of the case of the kid, Chanel Lewis, it really hurts my heart. And I tear up because, you know, initially the jury said no or whatever the case might be. And then they went back. And I don't know what happened, but this kid, I mean, and if you look at him, it's like, I just don't know. I just don't know. But I do want to give you praise and just say thank you for making a difference in our community. It's so many elements that destroy the black men in our community. So many different elements on so many different levels. And what you're doing is certainly, certainly making a difference in those who really need you. Those who really, really need you. And I just want to say thank you. I didn't have a question.
You're welcome, Brenda.
Awesome.
And I appreciate you as well.
Thank you for calling, sis. All right.
Thank you. Have a good one. Okay. Bye now.
You're welcome.
And if I can just comment on some of the things she said
real quick.
Chanel Lewis is the case out of Queens. A young man is mentally challenged. And anybody that ever met Chanel or watched the case know that he didn't commit this crime. And, you know, I spoke to his mother one time, and I offered to assist, and the offer still stands. And the problem with most of these cases, as Brenda talked about, is that black people are poor. Most of the time, you need experts. And if your family don't have money to pay for experts, and the prosecutor do, then the jury believes the experts that the prosecutor bring in, even though it may be junk science. There's nobody to oppose that on the other side. So when you talk about a case like O.J., they say, oh, O.J. got off. O.J. didn't get off. He just had experts. He had the money to pay experts to come in to talk about the evidence, to talk about the blood splatter, how the cops framed the blood on the sock and made it look like
to bring Barry Sheck in to talk about the forensic evidence, how the guy that was examining the evidence on the videotape wasn't following the proper procedure. They contaminated the results. The average guy doesn't have the money to pay experts to come in to break down how the procedure that was utilized in his case was faulty, and therefore a jury don't get to hear it and then make a determination of whether they should find him guilty or not guilty. So Brenda's completely correct, is that finances play a role in whether or not you get justice in the criminal justice system, and it shouldn't be that way. So I just wanted to comment on that. And Chanel Lewis, my heart goes out to his family. And again, and my offer stands to help that brother, because I know that he's innocent. He couldn't have had choked that lady and killed her. He's not strong enough. If you see this guy, she would have beat this guy behind, to be honest with you. She was a jogger that worked out. He definitely couldn't commit that crime. This guy don't even know where he's at, let alone he doesn't have a killer bone in his body. So, again, Brenda, thanks for bringing that case up.
Wow. I'm not familiar with that case, but I'm definitely going to Google it. You said his name is what?
Chanel Lewis, yes. C-H-A-N-E-L Lewis. And it's out of Queens County. And it's still being appealed right now by the Legal Aid Society, who I work with too on a lot of different cases. And you know, whatever I can do to help in that case, I definitely want to be – there's definitely something wrong with the DNA. I'm sure that they – if you go to the files, you'll find something. Or data files, something, you'll find something wrong with it.
Wow, yeah, I'm definitely going to Google that. So we're winding things down now. So can you give the family of those brothers and sisters that may be wrongfully incarcerated a word of encouragement that may be listening?
I would like to say to them to support your family member, to do everything you can to help them. Don't give up on them. There is always a judge out there willing to hear the truth. Organize, rally. Get all the support you can. Go to change.org and sign petitions. Call me. Let's go out and step on the doors of the district attorneys and make some noise. Don't leave your family member at the hands of those who gave them injustice. If you know that they're innocent, stand up and fight for them. But join hands with those who believe in it and just continue to fight. It's a long fight. It's not going to be easy, but it's well worth the fight and getting your loved one free. There's no feeling in the world and liberating a free man. The little best villain in the world is liberating a free man and having him out here to enjoy you, his family member, and him knowing that you fought hard for him. So continue to fight and use all your resources, and let's get those guys out of there that don't belong there.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Derek, before I let you go, how was your relationship with your children today? So you're a grandfather now, right?
Yes. I'm a grandfather about 8 and... You know, the relationship with them is the best relationship in the world. I'm always on the phone talking to the majority of them. We just was in the Poconos last weekend or the weekend before last, the family event. I mean, it's just amazing to, be able to be in their lives, even though they're all grown now, but just to be able to have those moments with their children and to just share the wealth and the knowledge and to be ordinary family. So it's just remarkable for me to be there with them and to have the relationship that I have and to know that the system didn't destroy that. That's the most important thing in the world, that we didn't let the system destroy our relationship. So it's great.
Such a blessing. You are such a blessing to so many. I commend you and applaud you for all of your efforts and reaching back, and because you could have very well gotten parole and said, to hell with it, and, I'm free now. But the compassion that you have and the commitment that you have for the other people, the other guys that are left behind, is commendable. So what's next for Derek Hamilton?
Well, we in the makings of the Friends and Family. We have a brick-and-mortar location on Clausen and Dean in Brooklyn. It's being built out as we speak. We plan to have it open by next month. And it's going to be a watchdog agency that advises the public on corrupt police, corrupt judges, corrupt prosecutors. And we're also going to teach law to the young, to the youth, so that they understand what their rights are, they understand what motions are, how to write a motion, how to file a complaint, how to be involved in the process, so they don't have to go into the criminal justice system like I had to in order to learn the law. So, we just going to empower people, man, to be advocates and to be lawyers and to fight a system that is counting us out. And that's just what I'm going to be doing next. And I think it's going to start next month. We're working on the location now.
Wow, that's so amazing. And so necessary. I pray that you're able to branch out and make it nationwide because it's so necessary in our community. Derek, I just want to thank you so much for being on Injustice tonight. Again, I apologize for the technicalities, but it's definitely been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. I would like to commend you and applaud you for all you've done and continue to do, and I know that God has some amazing things that he's going to take you to a lead, that he's going to lead you to do for others. So I just want to commend you and thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, sister, and I'm available anytime. Enjoy your night, and thank the
awesome.
Listeners for listening. Have a nice day.
All right. Thanks again. All right, you too. Derek Hamilton's story of wrongful incarceration is one that is all too familiar in the Black community. There are countless Black men in prison for crimes they did not commit. Thank God for his ability to learn the law and fight on his own behalf, as well as the behalf of others. I encourage everyone that's listening that has a loved one incarcerated to encourage them to connect with the jailhouse lawyers and fight this wicked system. Next week's guest will be Dean and Professor of Law of the University of the District of Columbia, Renee Hutchins. If you have a story of injustice you would like to share or would like to recommend a topic for discussion on a future show, please DM me, author Melinda Robertson, across all social media platforms. Thanks for tuning in tonight, and we will be back next Tuesday, same time. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe and be blessed.
Y'all ready to ride? Take a ride round the block now. Everyday scene, dope fiends and the cops round. At any traffic stop, we could be shot down. And in the courts, it's just us.